This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. With today's advanced transplant technology, you'd think that no one would die while waiting for a heart or lungs, but there are more than 115,000 people on the waiting list for organ transplants. 18 people die every day waiting for organs. Our guests today are in the business of organ donation and transplantation. They're looking to spread the word about donation and clear up any misconceptions about being a donor. You can join the conversation. Do you have personal experience with organ donation? Are you a donor or recipient yourself? Why do you choose to be a donor? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at wnpr.org or tweet us at wherelive. Our first guest is Peter Yu. He's an assistant professor of transplantation and immunology at Yale University. He's a transplant surgeon, and he gave up some time today to talk with us about this very important issue. And we welcome you into the studio. Thank you very much for being here, Doctor.
Thanks a lot, John.
First of all, what are the most common organs that are in demand? Maybe you can talk through the organs that are able to be transplanted.
Sure. Well, thanks for having us here this morning. The organs that we principally transplant in the United States are heart, lungs, a liver, kidneys, and pancreas. Not particularly in that order. Kidney happens to be about, accounts for about half of the organs that get transplanted in the United States every year, and the remainder are split between the other organs.
What are some organs that we might not think can be transplanted but actually are able to be transplanted?
Well, the parts of the eye have been used for transplantation. There are some new experimental transplants that have gone on around the country and around the world using the abdominal wall, limbs, face, and things like that. Those kinds of transplants are always in the news, so we hear about them from time to time.
Yeah, they are in the news, but they're very, very rare. We'll spend most of our time talking about the transplants that actually do happen an awful lot, starting with a kidney transplant. Why is it so common?
Well, kidney disease is a fairly common entity in the United States. It has to do with, to some degree, the rising rates of obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes as well. A large number of our patients carry these diagnoses and, as a result, have end-stage renal disease. Kidney transplant has been happening in the United States, or has been happening on the planet Earth since about the 1950s, and over the past couple generations, the techniques have really been refined. The medications that we use have really come quite a long way. So the survivorship from kidney transplantation has improved dramatically. So it's a therapy that we're able to provide to an ever-growing group of patients who have kidney failure. The additional benefit, the reason perhaps numerically why kidney transplant is perhaps a little bit more common than other kinds of transplant is because every donor has two kidneys, number one, and also because we're able to use live donors for kidneys when a cadaveric or deceased donor kidney is not available.
And we'll be talking about live donor donation a little bit later on in the program. In the case of something like kidney disease, is transplantation often still the best therapy, or is it just one of many available therapies?
You know, in one of my roles at the university, I teach the medical students, and I always tell them that the first lesson, there are basically three lessons that I try to get across in my hour lecture about kidney disease and transplantation. The first lesson, probably not appropriate for the radio, but the second lesson is that the best treatment for end-stage renal disease is kidney transplant. It's not dialysis by blood. It's not a variety of medications. It's not dialysis by belly. The best treatment for end-stage renal disease is by far and away kidney transplant. And when one does have end-stage renal disease, there are a variety of options for prolonging one's life early on. But each of these treatments ends up taking some time off the end of your life. So it's not fair to expect that someone who's on dialysis, which would be a life-prolonging treatment for someone who has end-stage renal disease, to really restore to that patient their expected lifespan. Our goal with kidney transplant is really to prolong the lifespan to as close to a normal life expectancy as possible. And in some cases, these kidneys can last for decades. You know, my mentors in Philadelphia performed a kidney transplant in the 1960s, and that was the first kidney transplant that was performed in Philadelphia at that time, and that kidney is still working, and that recipient is still alive. So well-cared-for, well-selected recipient, well-selected donors, these kidney transplants can last for decades and keep their hosts, their recipients, alive for that period too.
And we'll be talking through some of the other organs that can be donated and transplanted with Peter Yu from Yale University. We'll take your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 as we talk about organ donation and transplantation. I want to welcome in Caitlin Bernabusi, who's an education specialist at Life Choice Donor Services. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me this morning.
We had some statistics early on. Maybe you can tell us a bit more about what we know about organ donors in Connecticut. How many people are organ donors? How many people are in need of organs in the state?
Sure. Well, luckily we have a fairly giving state, but we could do better in terms of registered donors. About 42% of our state's population is registered. And when I talk about being registered, I mean through the Department of Motor Vehicles or AAA when you get your driver's license. We still have a ways to go. Some states are up into 80% of their state's population that are currently registered. And then we have a great need right now in our state for transplants, with over 2,000 people waiting for a transplant.
2,000 people waiting for a variety of different transplants, not just kidney transplants, but a variety of different organs. Is there one beyond kidneys that is more needed than others?
Well, definitely kidney would be the most in demand, and then liver is a close second runner-up.
What can you tell us about liver transplants, Doctor?
Well, the situation with liver transplants is it's commonly a little bit more dramatic than with kidney transplants, because with kidney transplants, there is a therapy that can prolong one's life while on the waiting list, and that's dialysis, as I mentioned before. With liver transplant, there really is no such therapy, and many of our patients come to us in the early stages of liver failure, when it would be fairly straightforward to do their liver transplant, when their care is fairly straightforward. But with liver transplants, you don't climb the list, get to the top of the list by waiting. You get to the top of the list by getting sicker. So the patients who are at the top of the list have the shortest expected lifespan without a transplant. And as a result, the degree of illness of the patients goes up very dramatically in places where there are prolonged wait times. So in places where there are high demands for organs, big metropolitan areas, in the Northeast, in California, and around New York and places like that, the demand for organs makes the wait times go up. As the wait times go up, the average degree of illness of the recipient is substantially higher. And so in some ways, the liver transplant field can be a little bit more dramatic just because of the degree of illness of the patients going into the operation.
I mean, from a medical standpoint, does it make great sense in your mind to be putting healthy organs into the bodies of the sickest possible people, essentially letting people get ill before they get the transplant they need?
You know, in a perfect world, when the diagnosis is made, we would go and find an appropriately suitable organ in the early stages of organ failure to be able to do an operation on a patient who's well-preserved, whose nutritional status is quite good, who hasn't had any recent infections or recent hospitalizations, to bring them to the hospital on an afternoon when they were just at work in the morning to do the operation in the afternoon and have them go back to work in a few weeks. Mm. The reality of the matter is that the patients do end up needing to get quite sick to get to the top of the list. And there are a few ways that patients can get exceptional situations that will put them at the top of the list. For instance, children and patients who have emergency need for transplant. But the reality is that these patients do end up needing to get quite sick, and to put good organs into these patients is really their only chance of survival in many situations. And so it does make good sense to do that, because when there are so many variables at play, people with recent infections, with heart troubles, and with poor nutrition, what you don't want to risk is the quality of the organ that you put in. Mm-hmm. That has to be a variable that's quite secure.
Now, the doctor's been talking about getting to the top of a list. Maybe, Caitlin, you can explain what the list is. What are we talking about here?
So in order to receive a transplant, you need to be listed through a transplant center. And the transplant center, people are always listed through UNOS, or the United Network for Organ Sharing. And that's the list when we talk about the 118,000 people waiting throughout the U.S. That's the list that we're talking about. And in order to get on that list, there is a significant amount of work that's done through the transplant centers in terms of testing, and that's probably something Dr. Yu can speak about better.
So in order to get on the list, obviously you have to meet some sort of criteria. How long is the list? I mean, people obviously believe that their illness is the most important illness, and it's very, very important for them to get to the top of the list so that they can get the much-needed transplant. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about how this list is constructed and what physicians and patients have to go through to get there.
Sure. Transplantation is very much a team sport, and you know, we like to say that we can't call you, you have to call us. So the first and most important step is a referral to the center. And once the referral is made, then an entire team falls into place to evaluate the patients from the surgical point of view, medical point of view. We have social workers, pharmacists, and I'm going to forget a few, and they're going to be mad at me if they're listening, but the nutritionists, the dietitians, the psychiatrists, the infectious disease doctors, cardiologists, the list goes on and on, and they're all part of our transplant team. For those patients who have the appropriate diagnoses and are medically suitable for transplantation, they go on the list. We start calculating their score from that day, and we watch their score. Either it goes up or it goes down. And as it goes up, they climb the list, and as it goes down, they fall down the list.
Can people go up and down the list because of the behaviors that they exhibit while they're on the list? This is something we've heard about. We're going to try to maybe debunk some myths or at least talk through some of the things people might think about organ donation. But indeed, if let's say you end up on the liver transplantation list because you've been a heavy drinker throughout the course of your life and your behavior is such while you're on the list that maybe you're not going to take care of the new organ, does that push you further down the list?
You'd be removed from the list. So if someone has a self-destructive behavior which caused their end-stage liver disease and they resume that self-destructive behavior while they're on the list, then they would probably be removed from the list and allowed to recuperate. And then once they've recuperated, we'd consider reevaluating them for transplantation. But people who have destroyed their liver with alcohol, who are listed, who resume drinking, do not get transplanted.
Do you have any thoughts on this or maybe other things we need to debunk or tell people about the list, Caitlin?
Well, just from the other side of the perspective, because my organization really works with the donation side and these people and families who have lost a loved one and are coming to make this decision about donation. And they're really making this decision not knowing who's on the receiving end. And they're putting a lot of faith in the system and the transplant centers to know that the person who received this most precious gift is going to take care of it and do everything that they can to live a long and healthy life.
Do you know how many of the organs that are essentially able to be used by people who have given up their organs for donation actually end up in recipients that then get the transplant and move forward? I mean, what is the recovery rate essentially of donated organs that are able to be then used properly within a surviving patient?
That really depends on the condition of the patient who is donating, who has died. It depends on how healthy they are as ironic as it sounds, but at the time of their death and how healthy their organs are. So, I mean, some people can go on to donate kidney and liver. Some can donate all organs. So that very much depends on.
Well, we'll be talking more about organ procurement in just a bit. We're going to get to some phone calls, 860-275-7266, as we talk about organ donation and transplantation on the program today. Hi, Daniel. You're on a cell phone, and you're on Where We Live.
Hi. I have a question. When a family member, like myself, donated, I have it on my license. If I passed away and my organs were supposed to be donated because it says it on my license, could a family member come forward and say, no, I don't want his organs donated? And if they did donate it, could they meet the recipients after the surgeries, or would that not be allowed?
Two great questions, Daniel. Thank you very much. Caitlin?
Those are great questions, Daniel. The first question that you had about the donor registry, our state of Connecticut is a first-person consent state when it comes to donor registration. So when you go to the DMV or AAA and get your license and make that decision to be a donor and to be on the donor registry, you're giving your consent at that time when you're healthy and well. So your family cannot override your decision after death. If you're over the age of 18, that's a legally binding consent that you have given. Regardless of whether or not someone is registered, the organ procurement organization always works very closely with the family so that they understand the process, understand the surgery that their loved one is going through, and then understands the beauty of the gift, so knows who the recipients are to some degree. Obviously, we have patient confidentiality that we want to respect on both ends, but we can give some information to the family about how well the recipients are doing. And then in time, we absolutely do encourage communication between donor families and recipients.
Doctor, you want to pick up on that?
Yes, sure. You know, it has to do with discussion with the family. And I myself am an organ donor registered with the state of Connecticut, and my family members are the same. And we've all discussed it. There's really no mystery between us who wants what to be done with their bodies after our death, in much the same way that you would make funeral arrangements, and those kinds of arrangements are clear. You know, the after-death wishes of the members of my family are known to me. And on that note, you know, it's important that, well, let's just say this. I don't get involved as a surgeon with the organ procurement until after the consent has been made and after all the regulatory checkboxes have been checked. But it's supposed to be a good experience for everybody, okay? And we certainly have patients who, after transplantation, are asking for a notepad and pen so that they can write a note to the family of the donors. And we try to facilitate that to the degree that it's possible, because I think it's important for us as a profession, for our patients, to experience that gratitude and be able to express that gratitude. And my sense from what I've heard back from the organ procurement organizations is that it's important to the donor families as well to sort of close that loop.
I just want to, before we take our break, which we're going to do in just a moment, I just want to make sure I understand this something. If you are registered as an organ donor, your family can't override that and say, we don't want his or her organs to be donated. But indeed, if you're not registered, can the family say, we would like this to happen, though?
Absolutely. So if someone's not registered, then the family will be approached to make that decision. And a lot of times they'll consider the type of person that their loved one was. Are they a giving person involved with the community? And then donation really makes sense.
We're talking with Caitlin Bernabucci from Life Choice Donor Services, also Peter Yu from Yale University as a transplant surgeon. When we come back from our break, we'll meet Carrie Mull from Donate Life. And we're also going to talk to a few people who've been involved in transplants. Beth Peters, who got a lung transplant a few years back, who we featured in a documentary here on WNPR. And we'll also be talking with Alonzo Bowden, who gave up one of his kidneys to his brother. If you want to join this conversation, 860-275-7266, or you can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. More than 115,000 people are on a transplant wait list. Every 12 minutes, a new person is added. There are lots of numbers and many statistics when it comes to organ donation. But what many advocates want to stress is that there are many more people who need organs than people who are official donors. Every one donor can impact more than 50 lives through the use of their organs. You can join the conversation. Do you have personal experience with organ donation? Are you a donor or recipient? Why do you choose to be a donor yourself? We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. We have a panel of experts in studio here, but we want to bring in on the phone Beth Peters, who's founder and producing artistic director of the Accessible Theater. She aims to increase access and inclusion to the arts for patrons and artists with disabilities. She has cystic fibrosis, and back in 2011, a documentary by senior producer Katie Talarski took a look at two 20-somethings, Beth and Brian, with cystic fibrosis and their transplant decisions. Here's a little bit from Beth after she got a call from the doctor that they had lungs ready for her.
Hello?
Hi, Mom. I got a call.
I knew it.
As the primary recipient. But I got to get everything ready. Carl's here in my driveway, so I'm going to go, and then I'll call you at the hospital to give you more details.
Okay, you're at Boston?
Yeah, at Boston.
Okay, so, all right.
And it's a young... It's a young donor.
I knew it.
Okay.
Yes, I knew it. All right.
Okay.
Bye. I know you're busy. Call me back.
Okay, I love you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Beth Peters from a documentary by Katie Talarski called Four Failing Lungs. It's good to talk with Beth once again on Where We Live. Hi, Beth. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. First of all, how are you feeling these days?
I'm feeling great. I'm feeling very, very good.
That is good to hear. So what are you thinking about whenever you hear that tape of yourself and the tremor in your voice as you were calling to let people know it's time for your transplant?
Well, it's kind of like a time warp. You know, it's funny. I didn't realize you were going to play that clip, and so I'm you know, it does take you right back, and your heart starts to palpitate hearing that moment play over again, and hearing my mom say, "I knew it." It's so funny. It's just, it's kind of a time warp.
Now, you were called in three different times before you got your transplant. Maybe you can talk about this process, the process of waiting for your lungs.
Yes. I was called two different times. The first call that I received, I knew that I was not, you heard me on the call refer to myself as the primary recipient. The first time I was called, they told me, they actually told me on the phone, you know, you're not the primary candidate, you're the secondary candidate. And they told me it's unlikely that you will be transplanted tonight, probably because they, you know, didn't want me to get too excited. And the second time that I was called, I did not know, and I stayed at the hospital almost, you know, 12 or 16 hours waiting to find out. So that process is definitely nerve-wracking. There were a number of months in between the first call and the last, you know, the call where I actually got my surgery. So the waiting game is definitely unnerving.
Just before the break, we were talking about whether or not people whose families want to find out information about the donor, whether or not they can find out information. You mentioned a little bit there in that piece of tape that we heard about the donor and what you knew about the donor. Maybe you can talk us through that process, Beth, because, you know, when Katie and I were listening through to that tape, this idea of a young donor, it's something that it's, of course, incredibly fortunate for you and incredibly unfortunate for that young donor. Maybe you can talk us through that part of this story for you, the person who gave you the lungs.
Well, I will say up front, I have not yet written a letter or contacted the family, and I have not, you know, received any communication from them. But I, at the time that they tell you that the lungs that you're, you know, that have been donated, there's kind of different consent process that you need to go through depending on the status of the lungs, if they came from a smoker or if they came from somebody with high-risk behaviors. And for my lungs, it was a secondary. I needed to do some secondary consenting because they couldn't really – they didn't know about my donor what his lifestyle was like because of his age. And in speaking with the donor's parents, I was told that when the surgeon talked with the donor's parents, they weren't able to really assess the donor's lifestyle. And I took that to mean that he was a late adolescent, but I don't know if that's true. That's kind of what I, you know, surmised from the conversation. So I did all of the secondary consent, unless, you know, not knowing if he was a smoker and not knowing if he was perhaps a drug user, not knowing his alcohol status or other lifestyle choices. So that was my particular situation.
And of course, these are lungs that came from a man. And you blog about this and you write about this and you talk about this. Did you feel different somehow, knowing that you had lungs from a young man?
Well, I worried that they weren't going to fit, I'll tell you that. and I know that I was told later in the weeks after the surgery that they were at the top size for what they could match to my rib cage and to my body type. But other than that, I didn't really consider, I didn't feel that strange about it. You know, I was just so glad to receive a transplant and be able to kind of start my life again.
Beth Peters blogs at cysticgal.blogspot.com, and she's the subject of a documentary that we've aired here on WNPR called Four Failing Lungs. She joins us by phone. We're going to get to some more of your phone calls in a moment, but I want to bring back in Peter, you, and talk a little bit about the specifics of lung transplantation. Maybe you can talk us through this and maybe how lungs are different than some of the other organs we've talked about.
Sure. You know, I should let you know, though, John, that lung and heart transplants are outside my specialty. I do liver, kidney, and pancreas transplants, but I do have a tangential knowledge of how lung transplants and heart transplants work. Lung transplants are an unusual organ allocation system because it's based on the concept of the degree to which someone's life can be prolonged by the transplant itself. So through a complex formula and calculation, given the recipient's age and degree of illness, there are other kinds of diagnoses that go along with it, a numerical score is derived, which can sort of predict the benefit that will be derived from a particular set of donated lungs. And that's different from the other organ allocation system. For instance, with kidneys, the organs are allocated based on waiting time. And as we mentioned with the liver, it's based on the degree of illness. So with the lungs, it's substantially a different system.
I want to get to a phone caller. Peter's on the cell phone. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Peter Kupczak. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind, Peter?
I'm a donor dad. My daughter gave the gift of life on November 23rd, 2002. After being declared brain dead after suffering a severe asthma attack. And my daughter was a registered organ donor in the state of New York, where she had just graduated school. And, you know, she fulfilled her wishes. She donated her heart, both kidneys, pancreas, and liver to two women and two men. And I'm very proud that she was an organ donor. I encourage everybody to register to be an organ donor. It is the greatest gift one human being can give to another human being. And it is, I'm just so proud of her that, at, you know, 18 years old that she had registered and we had talked about it. I remember telling her that I was proud of her, but unfortunately these things do happen. And I, would encourage everybody to register through the DMV. I know Carrie and Caitlin personally. I am committed to promoting organ tissue donation awareness at each and every opportunity. And I thank you so much for allowing me to share my story and to hear your story, and because you will educate people today, and people will think about signing that card.
Peter,
thank you for that.
Thank you so much for your phone call. And the Carrie that he referred to, Carrie Mull, director of the Connecticut chapter of Donate Life, joins us in studio. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
And you, so you were nodding your head. You know, Peter, it must be exactly the sort of story that you try to tell people all the time.
It very much is. Peter just warms my heart when he shares his story, as do all of our volunteers. Our organization's main mission is to raise awareness and educate the public about organ and tissue donation and how to register. And we do that only through the work of our volunteers. We have over 150 active volunteers like Peter that have a personal connection to donation, either as donor families, transplant recipients, living donors, or their family members. And we even have a few people volunteering that are actually on the waiting list that I heard you talking about earlier.
When we said before that about 42% of Connecticut eligible people are indeed signed up, why do you think the number is that low? In some cases, that might be seen as a very, very big number. Obviously, you'd like to see it higher. What are the barriers here for more people to register as donors?
I think a big thing of it is it's education. It's not having education about what organ and tissue donation is or believing misconceptions that are perpetuated in the media. It's a very flashy topic, life and death, and sometimes through Hollywood, myths are just perpetuated that are entertaining for the audience yet not true and create a disservice for the people that are actually waiting.
Are there any big misconceptions? If you had a chance to say one thing that people tell you all the time that they think is true that is just not true, what could you say?
The biggest myth that Caitlin and I face in the public is that if you are a registered organ donor and your something were to happen to you, that your life might be compromised by the doctors or medical staff that are taking care of you in order to get your organs and tissues. And that, of course, is absolutely not true because, as we heard from Beth earlier, we really need high-quality organs and tissues for transplant, and we're not going to risk organs that have failed or have been someone being let pass away for organs when actually we need these organs in high-functioning to save these people's lives.
Why do you think people think that, Caitlin? It's amazing that people would actually believe that a doctor would or a paramedic would just let you die in order to get your organs. This is still something that you hear.
All the time. I don't know what it is, high creep factor, but people really have this concern. I think that whenever you talk about death, there's so much uncertainty, and people want to know that their life is going to be the first priority for the hospital staff or EMTs. And I know Carrie said it, but we can't say it enough. It really is the hospital's priority to save their patient's life. Very few hospitals in Connecticut have transplant centers, so the hospitals that are taking care of you are not thinking about transplant patients. The emergency room physicians, nurses, staff don't know the people that are waiting. So they're not trying to let you die to save someone else.
And maybe in a moment we'll talk a bit about that process so that people understand that if indeed a potential donor comes into a facility, how organs may eventually make their way to an intended recipient. We'll do that in just a moment. But I want to talk about live organ donation as well. Alonzo Bowden joins us. He's a comedian who's been a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's a live kidney donor, and he joins us by phone now. Alonzo, welcome to our show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning to you. So tell us your story. Why did you give up your kidney?
Well, it was my brother. He was suffering from kidney deterioration, leading to kidney failure. And he said that he was going on dialysis. And, you know, I said I'd be glad to help him out. And fortunately, everything went well. And is Dr. Yu there?
Right here, Alonzo.
How you doing? He was actually my surgeon. And I'm guessing he did a good job. I was knocked out the whole time. So I can't really verify that he did great. But I'm still here.
I was going to say you're still there. So what can you tell us about this without violating any doctor-patient confidentiality here, Peter?
Sure. And Alonzo, I hope it's okay for me to discuss some features of your health care here on the radio.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Dr. Yu was great. He explained what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. We joked about it. I mean, it's a very serious topic, but the truth is, as a donor of a kidney, I can't speak for anything else. I can tell you the kidney, it was surprisingly easy, meaning that the surgery was simple, the recovery was fast. I was only in the hospital 3 days. I was back on stage a week later. And Dr. Yu's been good for some material ever since the surgery.
So yeah, back on stage a week later making fun of me, right?
Well, you know, when your doctor says that he's the Michael Jordan of surgery, I just told him that I hope he's number 23 Jordan, because number 45 wasn't really that good.
He's like, not the Birmingham Barons version, playing outfield in the minor leagues version. What else can you tell us about this case, Dr. Yu?
Well, I think that what you'll hear from Alonzo Bowden's experience and from other live donors is that live donors are extraordinary people. They come to our center many times hand in hand with the recipient, and sometimes they come forward anonymously and with just altruism in their heart, wishing to make a donation to someone. But when anybody meets a live donor and you understand the experience that they have, that this comes from a place of pure giving and generosity, the only real emotion one feels is awe at the amazing gift that individual makes. Now, the technical aspects of organ donation from live donors, you know, are complicated and fairly nerve-wracking for the surgeon. But we do it often. About 5,000 to 7,000 live donor kidney transplants will be done this year, and actually that number is substantially higher. I think that I may have that figure wrong, but the operation gets done with relative frequency, with exceptional degree of safety. And our patients do very well after donation.
Alonzo, I'm sure one of the things you were thinking about up until this time is you're giving up one of your kidneys, and of course it's for your brother, but indeed you only have one left. Did you talk through with your doctors, hey, what happens to me if something goes wrong with my existing kidney?
Well, actually, I didn't. I didn't bring that up because I didn't really think about it. They explained to me, and Dr. Yu, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but As I understood it, if something happened to my kidney, I would move up on the recipient list since I already gave one.
That's true, Alonzo. But, you know, the way we evaluated you, we found you to be in exceptional health with good health practices, with easy access to primary care, with a record of having been to your primary care doctor for a long time. And we found that the risk of you developing kidney failure down the road was so exceptionally low, even with one kidney, that it would be safe for you to donate. We have no expectation that you're going to have trouble with your kidneys down the road.
No, and I also did a repo agreement with my brother. I mean, let's not be ridiculous. He's borrowing this. This is not, you know, forever.
You can always ask for it back. One good thing, Alonzo, it sounds like if you're a comedian and you give up one of your kidneys, you do have material for years and years to come, don't you?
I have the right to make fun of my brother at any time for the rest of his life. That's just implied in the agreement. But honestly, what Dr. Yu's talking about, the level of testing I went through prior to the surgery was so extensive. It was actually comical to me to find out I was in that good health. I had no idea. Apparently, I had to start a retirement plan because I didn't think I'd be around that long. And these guys were like, oh, no, you're going to be here a long time. So it was all kidding aside, they do a great job. I had all these tests, and they told me that I was a great candidate, that I would be fine, and they did the surgery. And to be honest, I have no knowledge of having one kidney. In other words, there's no restrictions on my body, and I haven't done anything or felt anything. Like, I don't know that I gave a kidney.
Well, Alonzo Bowden, thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it, and continued good health to you and your brother.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alonzo,
see you soon, Alonzo.
You did great, and thank you.
Alonzo Bowden's a comedian. He's been a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you so much for your time. You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we continue this conversation about organ donation and transplantation. Quickly, Doctor, are there other organs or tissue types that you can give as a live donor aside from a kidney?
Yes. At Yale, we also do live donor liver transplantation.
And I assume people can find out more information through Yale if they're interested in being a donor.
Absolutely. You can go through Yale if they're interested in being a donor. We have resources to connect you to the local Donate Life organization, which Carrie runs, and to the national organizations. There's quite a bit of material on the Internet about that kind of thing.
We're going to get to some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. But I want to come back to Beth Peters, who got a lung transplant back in 2010. Beth, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about organ rejection, immunosuppression. This is something that is very, very difficult for a lot of people with cystic fibrosis who've waited for a long time for lungs. Maybe you can talk about that experience and how you feel your long-term prognosis is with these new lungs.
Thank you. Well, the issue of rejection and infection is kind of like a balancing act. And in my personal experience, 3 years out, my issues personally with infection, I've been 3 years out, I've gotten the flu 3 times. and I've had kind of more minor infections like that, more minor viral infections. I've had pneumonia, I think, only one time, an actual organized pneumonia. But there are a lot of patients that struggle. It was mentioned in the documentary, but not, you know, haven't mentioned today, that I had a sister who also had a double lung transplant 10 years ago, and she recently passed away. And her last year of life was very much plagued by a cycle of infection and rejection. And what that means is that, you know, when a patient begins a rejection process, they have to change their medications and increase their immunosuppression, which makes them more vulnerable to infections. And so she would get pneumonia, and then she would get better, or she would then have kidney problems from the drugs they use to treat pneumonia, and it becomes sort of a vicious cycle, which is problematic for many patients, and frankly, something I assume will eventually be a problem for me, though hopefully not for many years.
Beth Peters, founder and producing artistic director of the Accessible Theater. She aims to increase access and inclusion to the arts for patrons and artists with disabilities. She blogs at cysticgal.blogspot.com, and she was the subject of a documentary by our senior producer, Katie Talarski, for Failing Lungs. Beth, I'm very sorry to hear about your sister, and of course, we're all very sorry to hear about our friend Brian Circus, who
yeah.
passed away before he was able to get his lungs. But I'm so glad that you're with us and you're doing so well, and it's great to hear your voice again. When we come back from our break, we're going to take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Lots of people have questions about organ donation and transplantation. That's our conversation today, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about organ donation and transplantation on the show. A lot of people want to join us at 860-275-7266. So let's go to the phone. Wayne is in Hamden. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a recipient, and I received a kidney transplant January 10th of this year. And everything has been working fine. It was done by the Yale transplant team. I've met Dr. Yu. They're a super group over there. And the unusual thing we thought was that my donor was my wife, and which is really great because we're together all the time anyhow, and now we're really together. a lot of people thought that was very unusual, and I guess it's not that unusual. And the interesting thing is my wife did not know her blood type at all, and we went through the whole testing program, and I thought I was going to run out of blood, basically, with all the tests that they did. But we were compatible in lots of ways and had a lot of markers that were very similar, and everything has been fine. The Yale team is really great, no matter who you use there. They're just a great bunch. And, you know, I'd like to thank my wife and the team.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for sharing that. I want to get a quick response here from Dr. Yu, just because you raised something that's important. I think what our caller Wayne was saying was that people might be surprised that his wife is the donor. Maybe you can just go through a little bit more about who might be a good donor for a kidney transplant.
Sure. Wayne, it's good to hear your voice and to know you're doing well. So people have misconceptions about who can and can't be an appropriate kidney donor. And generations ago, you know, the very first few kidney transplants were done between identical twins because they wouldn't reject. The body of the recipient wouldn't identify the kidney as being non-self or being a foreigner. But with modern immunosuppression and our ability to manipulate the immune system, we're able to do kidney transplants between people who have a slightly lower degree of compatibility than identical twins. And people immediately think of siblings who have the same parents, or from a parent to a child. But how about people who have no blood relation whatsoever? Well, we are able to do those kinds of transplants, and we do them routinely. What's more interesting these days is what do we do when you have the heartbreaking situation of a patient who needs a kidney and has a supportive group of friends, family, and acquaintances who have all come forward as potential donors, but none of them is a blood match. None of them is an appropriate compatible match. So we give the example of Mr. Smith, who'd like to donate to Mrs. Smith, but their blood doesn't work together. And Mr. Jones down the street would like to give to Mrs. Jones, but their blood is also not compatible. So that what we've done is we've employed a computer program where we enter certain features about the patients and their blood types and things like that, and then we're able to pick out matches where we are able to do a swap. So four patients go to the operating room all at the same time with four separate surgeons, and rather than the Smiths donating to the Smiths, Mr. Smith gives a kidney to Mrs. Jones, and Mr. Jones gives a kidney to Mrs. Smith. And we've done those kinds of cases in-house at Yale. We also participate in long chains nationwide, where we recently participated through the National Kidney Registry with we received a kidney in the afternoon after having sent a kidney on to Seattle in the morning. And we participated in the second longest kidney chain in history, and I think it was 23 recipients long. Huh. And these are patients who otherwise would not have been transplanted.
That's amazing. I mean, how long are these organs good for? I mean, if you have a kidney, can it get all the way to Seattle? How far can it go?
Well, kidneys are a little bit lucky. They can last the longest, from what I understand, outside of the body. And we have a special pump for them where the kidneys get hooked up to this pump and they remain perfused with fluid so that they are more viable for transplant much longer days.
This is interesting. A lot of people want to join us here. Aliyah is calling from Hartford. Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. My name's Aliyah. I'm calling from Hartford, Connecticut. I've had two kidney transplants at Hartford Hospital. I just wanted to share that with people because it's an amazing thing. My first transplant was in 1998 by my mom. I had continuous rejection. And then in 2002, my youngest brother, Bilal, gave me a kidney.
And you're doing well, Aliyah?
I'm doing excellent. I'm 36 years old. My kidney creatinine still is 0.8. I hope to live a very long life. I just finished college at Central Connecticut State University, and I'm hoping to succeed in life just like a normal 30-something-year-old.
I really appreciate your phone call. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and continued good health to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We got a tweet from Jeff here, Carrie Mull, who says, is there a way to sign up as a donor before it's time to renew my driver's license? Well, that's a good question.
Thanks, Jeff, for asking that. Yes, in New England, any New England resident can register as an organ and tissue donor in between license renewals at donatelifenewengland.org. So all they have to do is visit this website and choose the state that they're a resident of and simply sign up. It is the same registry as registering at the DMV. It's just a easier online 24-hour-a-day registry.
Excellent. Very, very good. Jane's calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Been asking this question of ourselves for quite a while. Is my husband and I both signed up to be organ donors a long time ago on our license. Well, now my husband is going to be 93 shortly and has Parkinson's and asthma and some other things that have happened over the course of the years. And then I'm 77 and I had cancer 5 years ago, breast cancer. And we're just, I've wondered, are we still viable candidates to be organ donors, or at our age and with our conditions, should we just say, well, I wouldn't want to give an old, wouldn't want to be a donor to somebody young?
Well, it's a great question, Jane. Thank you so much for sharing that. Caitlin, do you have a thought?
First of all, I just praise you both for being registered as donors, and I hope that you share that decision with your family and encourage generations to give and be so generous. As far as what rules you out for donation, in general, we encourage people not to rule themselves out and to leave that decision up to the medical team at the time of death. We've had donors, organ donors, into their late 70s, and as we are an aging population, there are people in their 70s that need good kidneys, so they'll take kidneys from a healthy 70-year-old. But into the 90s, I think, is probably going to rule you out for donation, but I would just leave it on there and see where we are at that time. And then as far as cancer and other diseases, cancer does not automatically rule you out for donation.
I want to quickly get to Wendy, and we just have a moment or so left. Wendy, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I wanted to say that the heart has been on my license for a couple of decades now, and I think the best reason I did it is because life is an amazing gift, and when I pass, I want whatever is in good condition to pass on and live in someone else. Life goes on, and I am so grateful for all the doctors who can make our parts work in other people. The stories this morning have been amazing.
Wendy, thank you so much for the phone call. And we just have about 30 seconds or so left. Carrie Mull, maybe you can give people just a little bit more information if people are really interested in being organ donors, or if indeed they need to get on a list themselves. I mean, maybe just talk them through the process. Where do they go?
I really applaud anyone that's actually considered becoming an organ and tissue donor. As we've talked about, there's many people in need. And what I urge you to do is to learn a little bit more about it. Visit donatelifeconnecticut.org or donatelifenewengland.org and learn about what organ and tissue donation is. And then when you're at the driver's, the DMV, to renew your driver's license or state-issued ID, please consider registering as a donor, and you could save many lives in your decision.
Yeah, it doesn't really take anything more than just checking a box, and it does save a lot of lives. Carrie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you also to Caitlin Byrne-Bucci, who is from Life Choice Donor Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Dr. Peter Yu, who is from Yale University, is a transplant surgeon. Thank you so much for your time and expertise today, sir.
It's been a pleasure.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.